Thank you. Thank you so much. So, Ajahn, I thought to divide the time we have with you, a few minutes about this community building process, and another few minutes for people to ask questions. Does that
Yes, certainly.
sound good for you? Okay.
Yeah,
So,
certainly.
I'm gonna mute myself, but my before I do that, I thought I'd bring a little attention to you have so much experience, John. You have so much community building development in all kinds of arenas. And when I went to read your bio from the monastery website, there's nothing there that points to that. So I thought we can talk about
I
that.
was born, ordained, and now I'm here in California.
That's right. Yeah. So I'm gonna just leave it to you so you can talk about some challenges, some ways that are effective. How did Ajahn Chah do this? How are you doing this that we can, as a community, learn from all of your experience? Thank you.
Well, I think one of the things is first thing is that when we think of community and in the just in the traditional definition or description as Sangha, then when the Buddha himself described Sangha as a like in the classical chanting of recollection of Sangha, recollection of the of community, then the emphasis is on the actual conduct or training or practice. In the scriptural language, then it begins with like Supatipanna Bhagavato Sāvaka Saṅgho, so that the disciples of the blessed, or the blessed ones' disciples are those who practice well. So sup means sort of practice well, practice in a good way, practice with a foundation of a foundation of goodness, so that there's a and then that is inevitably translated as having a foundation in sila, in virtue, in the kind of moral precepts, because that is what leads to that's what leads to trust, and that. And then Ucchupatthipanna, so practice directly, practicing for knowledge and understanding, practicing with integrity. And so, but it's all around the that sense of, yeah, sense of integrity and being able to form bonds of trust, because harmony and a cohesive community doesn't arise, or it's very difficult to arise if there's a sense of mistrust or uncertainty or even a kind of fear. So that the Buddha's how do you say injunctions for conduct according to precept is not a moralistic one. It is a very practical one that leads again that leading to bonds of trust and bonds of and then it extends into, say, bonds of kindness and kindness and compassion, so that and generosity. Say, like one of the there's a discourse where the Buddha talks about the say the foundations of cohesion or harmony in a community, whether it's a small or large, in the sense of could be a family unit or friends, or it could be larger community. The very first foundation is the foundation of loving kindness, that one treats each other with loving kindness by actions by body, actions by speech, actions by mind, so that those our actions of body, speech, and mind are guided or rooted in loving kindness. And then the next quality is one of sharing with each other material benefits, material gains, so bonds of generosity. And that sense of generosity, giving, sharing, is how, as human beings, how we connect with each other, and that generosity can be both in terms of material things, but also just in terms of service or things that we do, just taking the time out to check in on somebody, you know, how are you doing? Being able to help each other in different ways, so that there's that quality of generosity is foundational. And then the final two are in terms of keeping a similar or a kind of consistent standards of virtue and integrity. In terms of conduct, that's sila again. And then the last one is around having a consistency and harmony of view, so that that sense of view in terms of perspective of what's important, what's not important, what's true, what's not true, what is that sense of view. And that, again, that's not from a Buddhist perspective, it's not an enforcement of some kind of doctrinal purity or something which just breaks people apart, but a sense of drawing close to people who share the similar values, similar goal, similar things that one feels are important. So that's where that view is really necessary or important, and how it. So all of those things taken together are really kind of provide the glue for that kind of communal harmony. And creating community on a practical level, in terms of my own observations of living with Ajahn Chah, and I think that in terms of communities that I've seen and experienced, You know, I think Ajahn Chah has a probably the strongest example of a successful community, because I mean he has not been teaching or from a last almost 10 years of his life he was bedridden and not able to help himself or communicate, and then he passed away in 1992. So, but the communities are still pretty functional, and that's exceptional. I mean, I've been around to a lot of monasteries, and especially when the teacher dies, then tends not to hold together for very, very long, and then people are off to somewhere else. So it's but Ajahn Chah is, I think, one of the unique characteristics of Ajahn Chah. Of course, the standard of sila was very strong, and a quality of virtue was very strong, and also that there was a period of time given to people to to make a commitment, and you had to commit to being, to live with Ajahn Chah. And that's really important, the sense of commitment, giving oneself to a shared purpose. Because most, as human beings, I mean, we tend to, and certainly America, is, well, what's in it for me? But the kind of community that Ajahn Chah was, you're required to actually give in a certain, not in any material way, but you actually have to show up and be present and share life with people, and sharing life with people, I mean, that's really irritating and messy. So it's that sense of there is this core of people who are committed to doing that. And that was the very, very first time that I met Ajahn Chah, paid respects. I arrived. I was already ordained as a monk. I'd been ordained in a city monastery. I was going to learn more about Buddhism, learn more about meditation, and then continue traveling and have my Buddhist experience. And I heard about Ajahn Chah. I heard about forest monasteries, so that I went up. I arrived early in the morning. Went to pay respects to the abbot, to Ajahn Chah, which is the appropriate protocol. And I might have finished doing my three bows, and Ajahn Chah just kind of looked at me and said, "You want to stay here, you have to stay at least 5 years." And that required commitment. And I didn't stay. It was sort of like, it was just too much. I went away, practiced in another place where I stayed for a little while, and saw, but I just, that whole yeah, committing myself was just too much. And but then I went away and I practiced in another place where I had solitude. I was able to organize my own routine the way I wanted it, and you know, blah blah blah. But all of the, I just kept thinking of Ajahn Chah all the time, and the impression, the teachings, and the example of community, and the integrity of the whole community, and not just Ajahn Chah as an example, or the monks or the nuns as an example, but the lay community. There's the whole community had this, you know, just incredible integrity and commitment. And I, yeah, I said, okay, this is, I need to do this if I want to really learn about how to live a human life in a skillful way. This is a really stellar example. So that sense of giving to a community or making a commitment of something, and those commitments can be, you know, just in small increments as one feels confident in. Because oftentimes we go to some, okay, I've got to make a commitment. So let me make this grand idealistic statement and then set ourselves up for failure. And that's, you know, that's problematic. So it's like, you want to just be pushing that edge of, say, of commitment, of generosity, of integrity in a way that we can grow into. And so that's another aspect. There's a practicality in the functioning of the community, that it has very kind of nuts and bolts practical ways of functioning and living with each other and helping each other and practicing the Dhamma. And then over the years of living with Ajahn Chah, and then taking on responsibility for leading community, which I did in Thailand as the abbot of the International Monastery for about 15 years, and then coming to America and setting up a Vaigiri, just continuing to learn and experiment and try to create a community that is able to sort of follow those principles. And one of the ways of doing it it's not just a meditation community or a mindfulness community. I mean, there needs to be, you have a along with the mindfulness, along with the meditation, is also times of especially in the world, that there's times of actually, say, one looking after a place and then looking after the people around one in some way, so that there is something beyond the individual, and then that individual is integrated into a larger whole. And that's where a commitment is, or that giving. And in doing that, then Again, yeah, I mean, it pushes up against our edges sometimes, but that's where we learn. And it's also where, and it isn't always going to be successful and it isn't always going to be beautiful. But being willing to learn, being willing to share and give. And that's where that foundation of trust is so important. See, these things all work together. So that when there is those foundations of trust and a sense of shared commitment, then, okay, yeah, things can go pear-shaped and difficult, and you can work through that and lift it up as something to be able to learn from. So that's because that's also what they say in terms of the whole path of the Buddhas is a path of learning, of education. With the Eightfold Path, oftentimes it's presented as Sila, Samadhi, Panya, virtue, meditation, wisdom. And those are called Sikha, the three trainings. But that the three trainings in Buddhism, that word also is education, learning, study. So that we're studying and learning through our actions and our meditation and our reflections are in the discernment, so that those are aspects that are important. And yeah, and sharing that path and working with each other. That's a really important aspect of say like community or sangha from a Buddhist perspective. So that's some thoughts off the top of my head. If anybody's got any questions, happy to.
Lumpo, I have to say, and thank you for allowing me to say that I have missed you so much. And I am so grateful to you. Thank you for letting me say.
Well, you would have said it anyway. So.
I
would have said it.
My heart pounds when I am in your presence, Lumpa. So I ask people, I put them together to talk about some challenge that they have in their life and to come up with some questions that we could ask of you. And so they have written some text here in the chat, and I will read them for you. Hopefully we get to most of them. So, So one says, how to balance the tension between the warrior energy taking action to impact this earth and the awareness of perfection of all that is, then the weariness and humility that weaves through this. How to balance that?
Yes. No, I mean there are those tensions all the time, and of course the way that the Buddha encourages us to be reflecting on is what dukkha. Is that sense of dis-ease, discontent, stress, suffering in different ways, whether it's minor or major. Those are the aspects of where we can reflect and see, because sometimes Because if we're just acting out of anxiety or fear, I mean, it's very stressful. And to not have, if one is in the human form, in the human condition, and one doesn't, it doesn't dawn on one that this is actually, it's a bit scary. You know, nobody, we didn't ask to be born. We certainly don't ask to get sick. Nobody wants to die. Nobody wants to experience loss in any way. But that's a part of the package. Inevitably there's going to be, some kind of difficulty that challenges us. So that sense of, but when the mind moves to anxiety, dwells on it or fear, then, we can collapse in on that. And that is really a source it's a source of suffering. To be able to say inspire the mind or lift up the mind in a way that is really skillful and certainly a point and mentioned it actually in last night's Dhamma talk that our default option as human beings is we opt to that negativity bias. We pick up on the negative more frequently than we pick up on the positive. And that's when that is kind of the baseline default option, then we need to put more attention onto the things which are positive, which are brightening the mind, which are energizing in a skillful way, in a very wholesome way. So that's why, there's different teachings that the Buddha gives that are using thought or using recollection. Like there's a set of teachings called the ten recollections, and the most of them are recollections that are very positive and uplifting, because that's what we need. And some of them are actually recollection of death. That's a bit more sobering. That's a bit more leaning to dispassion. So that has an appropriate place. But it is interesting that statistically it would be that the majority would be recollections that are positive. First three, recollection of the Buddha, recollection of Dhamma, recollection of Sangha, recollection of generosity, recollection of virtue, recollection of the devas, celestial beings, heavenly beings. And that recollection is more in the sense of, there are these heavenly beings and they are born in these fortunate realms because of their good karma, their good action. And so then it's an encouragement that, oh, this is natural. Or the of course the next one is then Marna Sati, which is a bit more sobering, but it's really useful because the need for not being heedless or not being careless or not taking things for granted. A recollection of the body in all sorts of different ways, and that could go either way in terms of recollection of the elements, or recollection of the parts of the body, or the recollection of unattractive nature of the body. So it's looking at limitations that we have, and then mindfulness of breathing is a very calming and soothing. And the last one is recollection of peace. And it's always equated with the peace of liberation, peace of freedom. So the sense of directing attention to what is uplifting. And that goes in, because oftentimes with, say, in modern practice circles, there tends to be a tendency to think that it's all about, say, like not thinking. Oh, so my mind, you know, I've got to stop my mind. I got to stop my mind from thinking. If only my mind would stop thinking. I wish it was more. It's so out of control. But it's more like, no, how do you turn that thought process, which is intrinsic to being a human being? How do we turn it to our advantage? How do we turn it to brightening and inevitably, the nature of the mind, the way how the Buddha kind of describes, is that the more that the mind is drawn to the wholesome, skillful, bright, happy states of mind, the more inclined it is to be peaceful because it is settled within itself. And it's like, and there's a few discourses where the Buddha is just really explicit in terms of, okay, you know, developing different meditation and ways of training oneself, leading to delight, leading to joy, leading to tranquility, leading to happiness. And then where he actually stops and says, the happy mind is easily settled. And it's like, that is where samadhi arises from. It's not from trying to squeeze your mind into some peaceful state. It's from settling and becoming so familiar with happiness and well-being that one is content to be with the experience that one's finding oneself in. So that sense of developing the wholesome, developing the positive, it's not just a kind of Mickey Mouse, rinky-dink, kindergarten practice. I mean, it's the foundation of a really wise human life.
Wow. Thank you. Wow. Thank you, Lupa. No, it's not Mickey Mouse. Oh, goodness. Questions, more questions. Someone is asking, community integration, please offer ideas on ways that Dhamma meditation communities can strike a balance between beginners and experienced meditators, meeting both needs along the path.
Well, I mean, I think one is again, this, I think, coming back to that sense of sharing. So that, and sharing and giving is a great way to form a bond between those different needs, so that you know, beginners, people with less experience can be, they have something to give to help support, to help be of service to. And similarly, that it goes the other way as well, where those who are maybe more experienced, they've got a foundation, and then giving and sharing as well of their experience or their guidance or their support in different ways. But it's also, that's where having a, sometimes having a actual kind of physical activities that one can be engaging in is like a meeting place, where just like sometimes having, of course now with COVID, I mean, it's really difficult, but the whatever place of say whatever meeting place there is, then being able to, you know, help support it, help keep it clean, help, you know, scrub the toilets. I mean, there's you know, those are very ordinary practical things that, yeah, everybody can be joining in with. And maybe you know, especially in an urban community where people are spread out a bit more, then you have to be a bit creative in finding things that people can be doing together. And it's that communal activity, communal endeavor that helps to form a bond In a kind of a tangible way, and then the other aspects of, you know, of meditation, of mindfulness, of developing deeper understanding, those things slowly grow.
So Lumpa, I have a follow up to that. Since now that we have opened this community to beyond location, you know, so yeah, many places around the world and mostly virtually right now. Yeah. Do you think it's possible to have that kind of a community since we're not together taking care of each other's the environment, but other ways? We have to figure out other ways of allowing people.
Yeah, I think it's helpful to, you know, to be kind of thinking other ways of doing it. And certainly part of it would be say like I don't know, just having times where you know, gather together virtually and doing, you know, meditating together, having time for reflecting, discussion is a helpful foundation. Having because then you can start sharing with each other different ways that, because that's what, you know, having a group of people and have a interest and commitment tend to be not short of ideas. And And sometimes the more difficult part is that sort of moderating or balancing these all these different ideas, and many of them really, really good. But how much can we, how much can we do? And then you know, in different ways of sharing, certainly you know, things like discussion, exploring different themes. Those are ways of like keeping it on track in some way in terms of having having a theme that one is exploring, or having a text that one's exploring. It helps to provide a bit of an anchor to explore from.
Thank you. Great ideas. Thank you so much. So Gemma is asking how to reach the state of peace and serenity when we're just human beings and we strive to be good people.
Well, I mean, that's as I was saying, that sense of focusing on, well, what is it that leads to a sense of, say, happiness and well-being, but happiness and well-being in a kind of a wholesome root, a blameless foundation. We don't have the language to differentiate. You say, well, it brings me happiness. You know, when I get, say, the newest kind of material object that's on the market, but that's not a very, it's happiness, but it doesn't have the same root as, say, the happiness of sharing or giving or hearing truth, drawing close to others who are virtuous or have integrity. So those are they're both happiness, but you know, they have different quality to them. So they're drawing close to the aspects of happiness that lay a solid foundation of, you know, kind of an inner well-being, is really an important base to be building from. And that peace inevitably, because that peace comes from, you know, there's a extensive discourse that the Buddha gave, and in it's quite one in the long discourses. It's the second discourse, is the fruits of a recluse. So that the Buddha is asked, what are the benefits of, you know, living a religious life, and the Buddha goes through all different kinds of happiness that come from just living a skillful life, and just the happiness of blamelessness, the happiness of you know, giving, sharing, the happiness of relinquishing or letting the kind of, say, hindrances drop out of the mind. So that all these different types of happiness are a base for to be cultivated, it has an effect. It's just quite natural.
Yes, the bliss of blameless living. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, oftentimes people, you know, ask me as a monk, you know, what have you, you know, what have you attained? What have you realized? and you know, what's your and level of attainment? I was, oh, I'm just, gosh, I mean, probably the main thing is I'm just really happy about all the things I didn't do. So I had lots of opportunities. So that just that is a big deal. It's not a small thing.
That is so kind, so generous. Thank you. So Claudia is asking, are there any mindful techniques that can be used during the transition from the old self to the new high vibrational self?
Yeah, just be mindful. it's all around suffering. Because again, we come up with all sorts of conceptions and idealized conceptions of what I'm trying to do, what I'm trying to be, trying to become, we suffer because of it. So and that's why the Buddha is so consistent in saying, pay attention to what are the triggers for discontent, dis-ease, for stress, because that's where, when we can relinquish and release and let go, that's where we're really at ease, rather than becoming some better person or some higher self or some, you know, spiritual being that the Buddha would pat on the head and say, you know, good little boy or girl. I mean, we tend to do that, looking at confirmation in some way, rather than bringing it back into the heart and say, how does this feel? What's the result of the practice? What's the result of the action? What's the results of my life? And that's what we can be learning from.
Thank you, Lumpa. So Matthew, who's coming from France, I believe, he says, your advice to leaders in the context of 2021 in terms of the leader themselves and how they can inspire their teams and communities.
Well, I think, you know, leadership always comes by example. It's not because somebody has bright ideas and intelligent elucidation of principles. It's more, how do people live? And in terms of leaders, what kind of example are they setting? What kind of person would you like to draw close to? You know, what kind of person would you like to hang out with? And that, you know, so it's that sense of just trying to be supportive, trying to be one who is trustworthy and is giving and kind. Those are you know, not in any idealized form, but in a sense of what is, what's a good, for leaders or leader in a leadership role. There's that sense of what kind of example, and then also just that willingness to give time to others, to be able to hear them, and be learning how to really listen to others. That's quite a gift. I mean, that was certainly in terms of my own experience of living with Ajahn Chah, he was somebody who always, he never asked us to do something that he himself wasn't doing. And so that was, you were always inspired to up your game, because his game was so much better than ours.
How blessed we are, Ajahn, to be in the presence and have guidance of such high standards. My goodness, thank you. So Balwinder, she is in Canada. She's asking, please guide me after retirement, how to give a plan, a new direction to new life journey in terms of vision, purpose, goals, values, still staying uplifted, lifelong learner, and still enjoying beautiful, peaceful, meaningful, balanced life journey.
You get all those superlatives in, yeah.
Until reaching funeral home, I think, which I do not want to go. Very fearful. How to get rid of fear of death too? Okay, everything she wants.
The whole package, yeah. It's coming back to those fundamentals of what is it that really resonates within the heart of ease, of comfort, of well-being, of happiness. That is really principle, and so that always comes back to on a very simple level of how the Buddha himself cast it of the foundations of goodness, foundations of punya. And generosity, virtue, and mental training. So that those are dana, sila, bhavana. Those are really foundational. Of course, from those, all of those have their subsets and whatnot that can be attended to and cultivated and developed. But I find it's always helpful to keep coming back to, well, what are the roots? What are the foundations? And making sure the roots are and foundations are really solidly in place and are being attended to with care, so that sense of, even if we're developing all sorts of various meditation practices or meditative perspectives, it all has to be rooted in just fundamental mindfulness or awareness, returning and being comfortable to keep returning to the quality of knowing, attention, and that everything else gets nourished in that way, as opposed to, I got to do this practice or I got to perfect that practice in order to have this experience, which is going to make me understand this one. It's all going to be rooted in fundamentals, so that clarifying the foundations, clarifying the fundamentals, and then and then experimenting and seeing, well, what helps to nurture those. You can do all sorts of different practices or trainings or have different, all sorts of different perspectives. But how does it support the foundations? How does it nourish the you know, those roots? And that's a really important perspective to keep maybe challenging oneself or encouraging oneself. So that's an aspect that lays a solid basis of growth, that where these different aspirations and hopes for one's life and one's practice will actually come into being.
Yes, up the game. Dumpak, she has a follow-up question. I know we only have a couple of minutes. She says, is it true that consciousness, universal energy in all living organisms is same? It exists within us, outside of us. Is it everywhere? Maybe you can give her some.
I'd say yes, but I wouldn't turn that into, keep it practical. You know, that sense of, yes, okay, that is a perspective that's not untrue, but it's also, how do we keep it real? How do we keep it practical? Because the mind loves to go to these inspiring concepts and just hates dealing with, our petty jealousies or our irritations and opinions of other people and whatnot, and so that, again, that's really being, rather than going to an ideal of consciousness and universal truths, those are, I mean, you certainly don't dismiss it, but it's also how to nurture or maintain one's that practicality of being able to not get entangled with the things that confuse or agitate or complicate the mind and our life, because even if it's true, we're still incredibly proficient at making things complicated and difficult for ourselves. And that's what has to be worked on.
Yes, thank you so much, Lumpa. Oh my goodness. So we are at 6:30 exactly. Wow.
Okay. Do we get through all the questions?
I think so. Yes.
Wow, great.